Welcome to the New Zealand Motoring Podcast, brought to you by podcasts.co.nz.
Hello and welcome to the New Zealand Motoring Podcast. I am Damien O'Carroll.
I'm David Linklater.
And I'm Cameron Officer.
Sorry, that was a very abrupt Linklater.
It was, wasn't it?
Yeah. I was excited.
Link sooner.
Well, it's been so long. We were going for a record between gaps between podcasts, I think, these days. But
I was just thinking, we kind of almost have to relaunch the podcast.
We do. We have to explain what we're all about every time we do a new one.
We talk about cars, sort of.
We do talk about cars, and we get sidetracked with other nonsense quite often, too. But anyway.
Oh, it's great to be back in the plush offices of the New Zealand podcast empire, though.
Absolutely. It is.
No. Let's talk about cars. Let's just rock straight into it, shall we?
All right.
News. And possibly what is the most unsurprising news ever, Ford has finally announced that they are bringing the Edge to New Zealand, eventually.
Done under a lot of secrecy, wasn't it?
It was.
Very.
This is amazing. When can I buy this amazing product?
Oh, well, they won't actually tell us that yet, nor price, and they still insist it's not a replacement for the Territory.
Well, it's not, though, is it? It's a different kind of vehicle.
Yeah. It does happen to be almost exactly the same size, but that's all right.
Yeah, but in a different way.
and there's every chance that it will actually even be called the Territory, too.
It's going to have to be, isn't it? Because
they can't call it Edge in Australia, can they?
Toyota Australia owns the Edge name.
Of course.
And I guess we follow whatever Australia does in the world of Ford, don't we?
Yeah, we do. So that means that it's status quo, different size, or different shape, rather.
Different shape, slightly different shape, a bit more American. Oh, and the wrong wheels are doing the driving.
Oh,
because it's
front-wheel
drive.
Well, not in all of them, though.
Not in all of them, no. It is four-wheel drive.
And I think they're
based on the Mondeo platform.
Yeah. So. And there are two big questions, though, aren't there? And one is powertrains, which they're not saying anything about. But number two, the really big one, is will there be a seven-seat version?
Well, that's the thing, because there is a seven-seat version being... I don't think they're actually producing it yet, but they're developing it in China.
I've seen pictures of a finished car, so I think it's very close to production. And Ford's talking about sort of a 2018-ish launch, and that's a very long way away. And that makes me think they're waiting... For something, and it could be powertrains.
Could be.
Oh, you couldn't release a medium size SUV. You couldn't bring a new medium size SUV to market without seven seats. You just couldn't do it.
Unless you're Honda,
because
the next step up is the Everest, which is significantly more expensive
and big
and a whole different box of cheese, as they say.
Phrase coined.
Yeah. No, I stole it. It's a pretty cool looking vehicle. One of us in the room's driven it.
I have. Yeah. I have driven it several times in different guises and in different countries, in fact.
You're an international man.
I am international.
Have you driven anything that would be remotely related to the one we get here?
Well, I do believe so. recently, I went on a trip to Jordan to drive Fords in the desert and was told to pay particular attention to a vehicle that they hadn't announced at that time but may be announcing in the future, which turned out to be the Edge. And that was the... I've forgotten the engine that it was. It was the turbo EcoBoost.
You've forgotten the engine that it was. It's very professional.
Very professional. I didn't do my homework. I completely forgot about it.
Because there's two sort of EcoBoost petrol engines, aren't there, for the car? Yeah.
Yes. There's a larger naturally aspirated V6 and the smaller turbo V6, both of which are... exceptionally good engines, I have to say.
Because they would have to be the ones they'd be looking at for New Zealand. At the moment, it's only produced in right-hand drive with a diesel engine and a manual gearbox, isn't it? And it's produced in Canada.
Yes.
For the UK market. For the UK market.
Hence the funny, quaint manual transmission diesel engine combination.
What's that?
Which is why, I said that's one of the big questions, because obviously that's one of the things they are waiting for. They have to have an automatic.
Yeah.
And they'll do the diesel, I'm sure, but they'll have to have an automatic diesel, and they'll have to have those petrol engines, which aren't currently produced with right-hand drive.
No. So hence the long delay in launching it here, I gather.
I guess it would take 18 months-ish for a factory to tool up.
It was a similar situation for the Mondeo, actually. It was launched.
It took forever, didn't it?
It took forever to get it in right-hand drive form. So.
And you know what? By the time the Mondeo got here, although it's a very nice car, it was a little bit old hat.
It was.
And part of me wonders whether the same thing's going to happen with the Edge. We've heard about it so much and waited so long. By the time it actually gets here in 2018, it's going to be a little bit old hat.
Yes, it is possible, because when I drove it in Jordan, I just like saying that, it was a very, very nice car, very impressive. The engines were fantastic, had a great transmission, nice ride, did everything really well. But even then, it sort of felt like last generation Ford stuff. It was not...
Tell you what Ford's not good at. They're good at lots of things. One of the things they're not good at is interiors.
Yes.
I reckon a lot of the interiors in Ford's cars feel a bit old-fashioned, even when they're brand new. And I'm worried...
Are you?
That the Edge is going to be a little bit the same. I've only seen the pictures.
Yeah.
But
lots of buttons. Too many buttons.
Quite a few buttons.
Yeah. Sync's really good, but just slightly frustrating.
Sync's a bit sluggish.
Yeah. And it's just,
once you've experienced some of the more modern sort of touchscreen systems, Sync does feel a little bit sluggish.
Mm.
But they've moved to CarPlay and Android Auto as well, haven't they?
Yeah, I believe it's one section in the Sync.
Sync's a bit like that back of seat touchscreen in the plane where you think you push something and you think it's broken, but it's just taking a wee while to get it. It takes you about halfway through a movie to realise you need to do
that's
something.
That's very true. Mm. Yes. Yeah. But it is it's a good looking thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's like generations away from a Territory. I mean, Territory was very nice, 34 years ago when they launched it.
Funnily enough, I have got a Territory parked in my driveway at the moment, and it's essentially like taking a trip back in time to about 10, 15 years ago.
It is. They did a
lovely car. But
they did a Ford Australia with it, which is to produce something fantastic and then just refuse to develop it any further. Yeah.
Enthusiastic owners, though. I've got a couple of people I know who own Territories in the real world, and they just absolutely rave about them. They think it's the best thing they've ever owned.
I've never been to the real world.
Yeah, I dip in and out. Yeah.
No, people do love them, and I like them too.
I'm enjoying the one I've got at the moment. It's a lovely car. It's a diesel, so it's not emptying the bank account at an alarming rate like the petrol ones have a tendency to do.
You're enjoying it so much you didn't drive it here today.
That's right.
Just saying.
Yeah.
Shall I? All right.
So by the time, I don't know, we'll have done at least another two episodes by 2018, so we'll be able to report in on that soon.
We will. I think it's an interesting vehicle. It's a tried and true formula. I mean, the Edge has been around in the States for a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, they had the Explorer there as well. And they were essentially the same vehicle.
Yeah.
They were very, very similar. They looked, they didn't look too similar, but to drive, they just felt pretty much the same. And the Edge is actually only fractionally smaller than the Explorer these days. So.
Yeah, because it's quite wide, isn't it, Edge? It's sort of, am I right in thinking it's shorter than a Territory, but wider?
I think it's wider, taller, and shorter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. American styles.
Lots of places in the interior where you can put an elbow when you're cruising along there.
That's right.
Elbow space. Elbow space.
Shall I talk about my news item, which is something else that may or may not be happening in the future, like the Edge? It's the theme for the day. Mercedes, the internet's a buzz in the automotive sphere because Mercedes-Benz has registered a number of names, starting with EQ. And many are speculating that this will be the naming convention for its new range of electric cars. So it's registered everything from EQA, EQC, which is actually a lot of pent-up demand for an EQC in Christchurch.
Regional joke that Germans won't
understand. That's right, yeah. So EQ, everything, including apparently EQ Boost.
What's that?
Presumably the performance arm.
Yeah.
And EQ Inside. We don't know what that is.
EQ Inside. That'll be their version of like Peugeot's iCockpit or something, probably, won't
could
it?
Be,
yeah,
could be.
Could be.
Anyway, so it's fairly well known now that Mercedes-Benz is doing a BMW and producing its own range of bespoke electric cars. So it'll be on the whole range will be on this modular platform. Really having very little relation to anything they make at the moment. It's a completely new range of cars. It'll be have this EQ prefix. And I think that we're going to see something significant at the Paris Motor Show about that. There's going to be either a launch of may not be a vehicle, it may just be a platform. It's like as I understand it, like a sort of a skateboard type platform, which is completely modular, fits batteries any which way, can be any size. So that'll be really interesting. And it sort of follows on from Mercedes-Benz launching a bunch of plug-in mainstream cars in New Zealand, which is also quite interesting, I think. So they've done a plug-in version of the C-Class, of the GLE, which we used to know as the ML-Class, and also the S-Class, and there's an E-Class coming. Mm. So the E-Class is sort of the newest one. The E-Class is a brand new model. And so they are really just hybridized versions of conventional cars. They do about 30 Ks on electric power and, you know, take X number of hours to charge up. And they all have petrol engines as well, so you get decent range. So the interesting thing to me is the different ways around that the companies have done this. Like BMW started out with this bespoke range of electric cars, and lots of representatives from other companies sort of rubbished them at the time, not naming names, but they said, it's extravagant, it's too soon, blah, 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 blah. But I mean, BMW had a completely different philosophy. Their idea was to establish their brand as sort of the leader in electric car technology, which they've attempted to do with the i3 and the i8, and then go to the plug-in sort of hybridized, you know, versions of its mainstream models, which it's now doing. You know, BMW is another company that's now just launched a whole bunch of plug-in cars. They've got an Active Tourer, they've got an X5, they've got a 3 Series. Mercedes has done it the other way around. You know, they produce those plug-in cars first, the mainstream ones, and then they've now on the verge of announcing this plan to make these bespoke electric cars. So interesting times. I think Audi's going to do the same with the e-tron brand. They'll have a bunch of
They've been threatening that for a long time, haven't they? But just sort of,
so these plug-in versions of the Mercedes that we're seeing now will be a weird cul-de-sac in the sort of generational development of their
very cars. Much so. And you know, I think they only exist just to help the brand meet its emissions obligations overseas, really. You know, they're a must-have, otherwise, you know, you're in trouble in terms of emissions. But yeah, it's not even a step to somewhere, really, because the step, you know, the place where they're going, it's already underway. It's not like a step in development, you know. It's as you say, it's a cul-de-sac. It's just a little
And what EQ stands for?
That's
interesting, eh?
Electric
quantum.
Whatever it is, quasar. Whatever it is, it'll be two words joined together with capitals.
And it'll have Tronic on the end.
EQ Tronic. That's quite cool.
So they're obviously, the naming convention is obviously very much in line with what they do at the moment. The last letter indicates the size of car that it is. So you'll have an EQA, which will be equivalent to an A-Class, although it won't be an A-Class, it'll be a completely different car. EQC will be equivalent to C-Class, et cetera, et cetera. Have an E equivalent to the E. So, yeah, there's a big range of electric Mercedes-Benzes coming, I think, is the message there.
Yes, yeah. There's a lot. Well, they've been, I mean, well, we saw just recently they didn't mention the EQ stuff, but they released all their models for the next sort of 18 months publicly, which is unheard of. Nobody ever does that sort of thing. And they just released, here's all our 2017 models, including things like a Ute, which was obviously the worst kept secret in the world.
That's in Devara.
Yes. But also, the one that was interesting was the all-road style E-Class estate.
Which is an intriguing thing, and I think probably go down quite well here in New Zealand. We love our SUVs, we love our crossovers.
So they're feeling very bullish at the moment, aren't they? They really are very proud of what they're achieving on a global stage.
Well, they've been on such a roll with model launches. I guess that was part of the thinking behind that, is just to demonstrate, you know, hey, we're not finished yet. There's a whole bunch more coming.
That's right.
So, yeah, very interesting.
Well, speaking of trademarked names, that seems to be a theme, doesn't it?
Segway.
This is another sort of item of news that sends the internet into meltdown. Honda have applied to the European Union Intellectual Property Office for the letter combination ZSX. Now, the best conclusion anyone can draw from this, of course, is that we might be looking at a baby NSX at some point soon. Which
would make sense, wouldn't it? Because the NSX is going to be megabucks.
Yeah, yes. Well, it's weird. It's $150,000 in the US, but of course, if you ever brought one in here, I mean, yeah, by the time you've converted, by the time it's available, it'll be about 10 years away. but anyway, if there was a right-hand drive one, I mean, people are sort of talking $400,000.
Yeah, yeah, Ferrari. They announced that in Australia, that was the price was about $430,000 or something.
Yeah.
So if there was to be a baby NSX in the US, they're sort of talking maybe Porsche 718 Cayman money. Of course, that's only $120,000 in New Zealand. So again, you're probably thinking 911 money, really, wouldn't you, for a baby NSX? So that's one aspect of it, which is, again, it's a good stepping stone to the performance area of their brand. Although, of course, it's Acura, not Honda.
That's another car Acura. That's just been so Acura. Long coming, hasn't it? Yes, how long have we been talking about NSXs?
Yeah. I mean, there's lots of first drives, but no real sort of world test. And so the power side of things, of course, the NSX that's still about to come is alleged twin turbo 3.5 liter V6 with electric motor assist, and they're sort of saying there is a 2 liter four cylinder turbo from the northern hemisphere market Civic Type R that would work quite well.
Oh, there you go.
In the so called ZSX. So, and the inside, there's always an insider involved. There's an insider in Honda's told an Italian motoring blog that apparently we could see something as early as Detroit next year.
Oh. Insider is sometimes code for I just made this up.
I interviewed my keyboard and here's what came out.
I wonder whether it will be a true baby NSX though, if this car exists. Will it be like a, you know, mid-engine sort of baby supercar?
They might do a McLaren and simply use the same platform with a smaller engine and
shrink it down.
If they're going to do a McLaren, the smaller car would actually have to be bigger than the larger car as well.
Because the NSX only exists in marketing renderings, nobody's actually seen one in the middle.
No, that's very true.
So nobody knows how big
that is.
That's
true, that is true.
I mean, is that as big as a 458 or is it as big as
I have no idea.
Who knows?
We don't know.
Well, because Honda have got a history of doing smaller versions of cars. Because they did that little S660 not long ago, sort of a scaled-down, mid-engined.
I saw one. In Auckland.
Yes. I did
too. It caught my attention.
I stopped and looked at it.
It was very cool.
What's it a scaled down version of?
Well, it was a scale. I was going to say it's a scaled down version of the S2000. But it's actually a mid-engined.
It's very cool.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Like it's very cool in a cartoon.
It's basically a what was that little K car that they did, Honda? Beat.
The Beat.
Oh, the Beat.
It's essentially a new version of the Beat, but it's got NSX styling all over it.
Right.
And it's just, it's fantastic.
It's a cool little car. Wow. Yeah, if you like sort of cartoon cars, I do.
Oh, I love Japanese K cars. Very cool.
Yeah. So, you know, they've done it.
Yeah, well, we'll see what happens. I mean, we might not have to wait for very long, but we'll see.
Well, I think you'll find we will.
Well, we won't have to wait very long until they go yes or no.
Yes.
And then, as the NSX has shown us, you do have to wait a while.
Hands up who's been snow driving.
Oh, you can't see it, but I'm putting my hand up.
Me too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm the only one in the room who's not putting his hand up.
No. You went to Jordan.
So I went sand driving.
Did you go to Jordan? You should have mentioned that.
Yeah. This is the first time we've mentioned even to each other that we went snow driving.
Yes.
So we're both premium car makers, I suppose, have this fascination with snow driving in New Zealand. Yeah.
Because we've got an amazing facility here.
We have. What's it called?
It's called the Southern Hemisphere Proving Ground.
Yeah.
Part of Snow Farm in the Cadrona. And one of a kind facility for this hemisphere, as the name would suggest.
And it's a very globally important facility because, of course, it's the off-season here.
Yeah.
In relation to, the Northern Hemisphere. So car makers come and do all their winter testing down here when it's the Northern Hemisphere summer. So it's a big deal.
And about 45 different companies each season, from full, auto manufacturers to tyre makers and auto component makers.
The tyre manufacturers are the biggest contributors to it. They use it the most.
It's a clever facility because there's
amazing place.
All these different areas, 16 separate facilities within it. And it's arranged around the mountain so that several companies can be in residence and not really come across each other too much.
Yeah, the day that I was up there with the company I was with, which will be revealed in a moment. there were all the facilities were full. There were 16 different companies up there testing various things that day, and we didn't see anybody the whole day. It's amazing. It's like 40, is it 40 hectares, I think?
Yeah.
It's massive.
Yeah, it's an entire mountain. I mean, it predates the RMA, where you just lop the top off a mountain and make a big... And it's quite cool, because I flew in via helicopter. Yes, and as you approach, you sort of see all these things that look like rocks, and then you realise there's a weird symmetrical pattern to it at all. And that's actually fence markers for tracks, race handling tracks.
Well, of course, because it's the Snow Farm is sort of technically a separate facility. They're side by side.
Yeah.
But the Snow Farm, the day that I was up there, there were apparently several Winter Olympic athletes training up there as well.
Interesting.
That's another group of people who come down there to do all their training.
Funny you say that, because there were cross-country skiers when we were there.
And well, there you go.
I thought it must be the only place you can go cross-country skiing and see a premium European car going past sideways. Yes. Just on the other side of a wooden fence. That's quite amazing. A quiz question for a nominal 3 points. Which was the first car company to suggest to farmer
Toyota.
John... Oh, damn it. I thought that was going to be a really interesting fact. Oh, no. Yes, you're right, though. Toyota. And they said, well, we want to do some ABS braking testing up here. And apparently you can still see the original ABS strip. It's in the car park outside the Snow Farm.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
That's a better fact.
Yeah.
So anyway, we're sort of rambling a bit, aren't we? But basically...
nothing new in that.
Car companies with well-heeled customers, which are the likes of... Audi and BMW and Mercedes-Benz and Lamborghini and Aston Martin they love taking their customers snow driving, so you know, if you're keen, you pay your money and you get taken up there and you spend a day doing skids in the snow really for no good reason other than it's great fun.
What car did you do your skids in?
Oh, well, I went up with Mercedes-Benz, but that is incorrect. I was up there with Mercedes-AMG, and what makes Mercedes-AMG slightly unusual in the snow driving sphere is that they not terribly interested in taking all-wheel drive cars up there. They like to take rear-wheel drive cars up there, and so that's even more fun / harrowing.
Well, I was going to say, it must be absolutely mad. I mean, I was there with BMW, and we were in all-wheel drive X-Drive vehicles as far as what we were driving, but... well-known BMW driving instructor Mike Eady was there to do the world's coldest hot laps, and he was in a rear drive M3 sedan. And it was, I mean, for a very good wheelman like him, it was still a struggle to get around these handling tracks at speed. So I can only imagine. Oh, sure, for an ace driver like yourself, it was easy.
But I like the fact that you said wheelman with a straight face. in some sense, it's irrelevant, the fact that you have 400 kilowatts or whatever, because it has the same amount of traction as a 1.8-litre sedan.
That's right.
It's really, I mean, the reason why they take those cars up there is probably to get some of their more special customers into a range of vehicles and just for the noise. I mean, it's great hearing V8 engine at full song,
crackling
at 3 km an hour, with the wheels spinning. But just as a, because they don't do things by halves. So I made a list of some of the vehicles that we had up there. We had a GTS coupe, we had an SL63 roof down.
Nice.
We had C63S, and they did actually have a selection of 4MATIC, which is Mercedes speak for all-wheel drive vehicles. Had an A45, a CLA45, and a GLA45. So we did some separate exercises just designed to showcase the four-wheel drivishness of those cars.
Hill starter system, that sort of stuff.
No, skids.
Skids. Still skids.
Yeah, still skids. It's just great fun. What brand were you up there with?
Well, as I say, I was up there with BMW. We were driving all the X-Drive vehicles, the X1, X3, X5, X5M, X6M.
Oh, that's all right.
Which, again, sort of fulfilled that lots of noise, not going very far, very quickly sort of component. And most interestingly, the 740D X-Drive, which I drifted.
Yeah.
So it's quite interesting, trying to drift a $200,000 Luxo barge around. While a German called Lars screams in the RT at you, faster, faster, power, power. You think, oh, it's a comedy accent. You realise it's just a German accent, actually.
Although, theoretically, I hate to rain on your parade or snow on your parade, as the case may be, but surely a long wheelbase vehicle like that is actually very easier difficult. To drift than a short wheelbase one.
Until I got into the X3, I got into that, started getting to grips with that. I thought, well, this is kind of, it feels more natural, because of course the thing is with four wheel drive or all wheel drive is it's not like the movies. You don't drift counter steer.
No,
you've got to steer into the drift.
Yes, you do.
And every fibre of your being is saying counter steer, but you don't. Yeah. You've got to feather the throttle. It's you lose control when you power it off.
Yes.
So it's a very strange. Bizarro drifting world.
You've got to go against everything that your mind and your body's telling you, and you've got an angry German yelling in your ear, telling you to do the thing.
He liked to yell, power, power, faster, faster. And then when I was out there, he often yelled, ay, 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 as well. So That was quite encouraging.
That was actually an issue that we had because we were going from rear-wheel drive cars to four-wheel drive cars, and the point of it was to demonstrate the different ways that they work, but I found it incredibly difficult to get into the four-wheel drive cars after the rear-wheel drive cars, because the rear drive cars are just instinctive. You know what to do.
Yeah.
But as you say, with a four-wheel drive car, you have to power to steer.
Yes.
And that's why I crashed the GLA 45 into a bank.
Did you?
Twice.
Oh. I won't name who, but somebody who works for BMW crashed one of the actually we also had the 3 Series X-Drive. They crashed the 3 Series X-Drive into a bank.
Yeah, and snow's quite hard when you crash into it.
Yeah, it's not soft and forgiving at all.
No,
was there any damage? Or
no damage to my car. I was doing a lap of what they call the big circle up there, which is a big circle of snow and ice that you're supposed to do a relatively high speed drift around.
Yeah.
I lost control of the car on my first lap and went forwards into a bank, and they towed us out and there was no damage, and then I still had my confidence up. I thought, oh, I'll give this another go, I know what to do now. And then I went into the bank backwards. So
you completist.
And I just sort of do it both ways, and no damage. But there there were cars damaged on my day up there, and they're philosophical about it. They shrug. They say, the poor little A45 went into the bank about 4 times and ended up with its front bumper hanging off. But that's why you're up there, I guess.
I suppose it is.
So it costs. It's run out of Australia, this particular program, because Mercedes-Benz is kind of based in Australia, and it's $4,500 to come and do it for the course that I did.
Is that including airfares?
I believe so. So you get, you only get one driver, but it's for 2 people. So you get 2 nights at a hotel and 2 dinners at very nice Queenstown restaurants, and your partner can come up and spectate if they want to. And some people did, and I think wished they hadn't, because it's not that interesting standing in the freezing cold watching people do skids for a whole day.
No.
Apparently lots of people don't. They just go shopping in Queenstown or whatever. But sounds awful to say reasonable value, isn't it? But
the BMW one's about 2.5. It doesn't include airfares.
Yeah.
Include a helicopter ride.
Does include a helicopter ride. Does include staying at Millbrook for a couple of nights.
Yeah, that's very nice.
I mean, when you think about it, in itself, that's probably $1,000. I don't know. No research involved in that.
I mean, these events are really heavily subsidised by, I think, the factory, basically. Who shall remain nameless, who works at Mercedes-Benz, told me that it costs, just the transport costs to get the car up there, it's $3,000 per car just to get it up the mountain.
Gosh.
Yeah, that's incredible, isn't
amazing.
It?
Amazing.
So these are all part of factory programs. We actually had a journalist from Auto, Motor and Sport with us, who was a very accomplished sort of snow driver and racing driver, and made us all look incredibly bad. But he was just blown away by the whole facility, because he said he does lots of snow driving. They do it all the time in Europe, obviously. But he said it's always on frozen lakes.
Yes.
And, you know, so it's great driving, but it's not spectacular like being on top of, Mount Pisa. Looking down on Queenstown. That's amazing up there.
That's the same reaction this guy Lars, who he's 25 years in motorsport. He's been German rally champ 4 times. He's been working for BMW for 15 years. And he says it's, hand on heart, says one of the best facilities he's ever encountered, because it's so spectacular.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing. On a good day, which I think we both had.
We both had. I can imagine if you were up there testing tyres in a blizzard, it wouldn't be that
I've been up there on a bad day and it's not nice.
Well, funnily enough, I did the BMW X Drive about 5 years ago. This is the 7th year it's run. And I think you might have been there too, David.
I remember.
It was the slush fest. Yeah, there was slush up to the door sills, and to the point that we actually had to throw in the towel, drive back down the mountain and go for a nice drive through the Mount Aspiring National Park instead, because we just couldn't do what
we did. I had a day up there years ago with Audi, and a very similar situation, and they ended up getting us up there very, very early. I think we were up on the mountain at 6 and we had to leave about 10:30. So we got sort of 4 hours of driving in, but it was just all over by then. It was just slush and the weather was awful. So
I think when you strike it lucky, it's great. If you pay all that money and get over here and it's not so good,
it's the luck of the draw, isn't it?
It is.
It's still exciting. I mean, even if you went up there and it's a blizzard, it's still an experience. Not many people can say they've been up to the Southern Hemisphere Proving Ground and driven in the snow. So I think more power to them. I hope they continue to do it, because it's just great.
Actually, Cameron, I noticed there seemed to be one glaring omission from the BMW four-wheel drive lineup in your list there before the X1. Oh, no, that was there.
He said the X1.
He did say the X1. Okay, yeah. I didn't hear that. I apologize, yep, no, but I was just wondering how...
even though it's not X Drive.
That's the
Well, that's right.
How did they get around
it? They didn't have an active tour either. Because that's not an X Drive either. So.
No. Anything on a mini platform is not X Drive, but they call it X Drive.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
Don't get me started.
No. I was just wondering how they explained didn't have an around that.
Oh, they didn't really. Well, that's the thing, you see. I think you've got mainly customers there. They don't expect too many questions about why is this model not there and why is this one. They did have the plug-in X5. So that was interesting too.
Yeah.
And that temperature, it would have had a range around a kilometre.
That's right.
Well, no, under those conditions, like full throttle skids on snow probably had a range of about 300 metres.
Yeah, that's right. No, as you say, it was great fun. Great fun to do.
Mm. Yes.
All right. Driving.
What have we been driving? Well, I have been driving possibly the largest thing.
Well, we know you haven't been driving the Territory.
No.
I only just picked that up. I have been driving, I want to say the Dodge Ram, but it's not anymore. It's the Ram 2500.
No.
I was going to ask about that. So that's a standalone brand now, is it?
It is. They spun off
Ram. It's their light commercial brand. Yeah.
That's hilarious. So what was that like in the environs of Devonport, Grey Lynn?
Actually not as awful as I would have expected. It was actually a relatively easy vehicle to get around in. Parking, on the other hand, was a horrifying nightmare.
Yeah.
But driving it around, it's you just got to remember the length when you're going around corners and don't take out a Mini or something parked on the side of the road.
Because how long is it? It's like 6 metres, isn't it?
It is something like that. It's colossally long. I knew you'd ask me that, and I didn't, actually.
Is it as long as that?
I was just feeding you that question because I assumed you would know.
You assumed I was competent. I can find out, though.
Would it be long as that Wrangler Brute, that ute version?
Longer. It's longer.
Yeah. Wow.
I'm going to do a Damien now and say I've actually got it at home at the moment.
You didn't want to bring it to the central city. Yeah. Why not?
Well, you mentioned Devonport. I actually, because my son, who's 10, was mad keen on going in it. We actually went down into Devonport on a Saturday night to pick up some pizza in the Ram.
Yeah.
And I did actually park it in a standard car park between two cars. So it does fit.
It does.
But
right.
It does.
You've got to be careful. Yeah. It's tight. Yeah.
Is cameras all around? No.
It's got a camera at the back.
A camera at the back.
Two cameras at the back.
It's got cargo cam.
Cargo cam.
Oh, what's cargo cam?
It just looks into the tray.
Oh, cool.
That's which, brilliant. To be fair, is such a long way away from the driver. It is a handy thing to have.
Sorry, I'm horning in on Damien's road. No, just that I'm excited.
It is over 6 metres long, by the way. It's 6,027 millimetres long. So it's utterly immense. It's just amazing. It's the steering feels like it's a couple of rubber bands and a few pulleys to attach to the wheels. It's just so vague and distant, and it's got the ride is.
Awful.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to go that far.
Bouncy? But awful?
Awful, yeah. We went out on a gravel road to do some photography, and it's just about undriveable at anything over 30 kilometres an hour. It just bounces around everywhere. I imagine you get a bit of a load on, it would settle it down.
Yeah.
But the Ram, it's all about towing.
Well, as I said, all of what you've just said would mean nothing to the people who want to buy that.
No, not at all.
No, no, no.
Doesn't matter.
I mean, it's got a 913, I think, kg payload, which is pretty average for something. I mean, that's what a Range will take.
6 metres, how much is tray without wanting to make you delve into the stats again?
Some.
It's hard to say. Yeah. Some of it.
Not as much as the rest of
it. It's got a big cabin.
It's got a huge cabin.
Yeah, yeah.
But it can actually tow 6.9 tons.
Wow, that's huge.
So if you
that's
stick,
massive.
Because that's 3.5 tons, isn't it?
It weighs 3.5 tons. Right. It can hold a ton in the tray.
Wow.
And it can tow 6.9 tons. So that's
you put anything decent on the back of that, and you need an HT license.
Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. But it's all right because it's got exhaust brakes.
Oh, is it really?
So it is essentially just a smallish truck.
Wow.
There's nothing like cruising down the hill into Devonport going
no engine braking.
Wow. So I mean, everything about it, I mean, it's got a horrible ride. It's it's way too big. It's got vague steering. You should hate it, but it's just so cool.
Center stack from about 2004. Yeah.
The best thing about
column shifter.
Oh, column shifter.
On the doors, it's got fake wood, and it's got a little Ram sort of embossed plasticky chrome look thing.
Yeah.
But the typeface is straight out of the 70s.
It is.
It's like you would see on a Holden Kingswood.
The whole thing. It's relatively modern inside. I mean, it's
got all the Chrysler like Uconnect.
All the design. It could have just come straight out of the 70s.
Wow. So that's obviously all on purpose.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so let me just, because I'm haven't driven it yet. I look forward to it. So you can buy this as a right hand drive vehicle now.
Yes.
How much for?
I believe $163,000 for the 2500.
Wow. That's for the soft one.
Wow.
Because the 2500's soft. It's got doesn't have leaf springs on the back, does it? Whereas the 3500's
got leaf springs. Wow. Can actually, I believe, tow less but carry more in the tray. The 3500.
Okay. Right.
So they're converted in Australia.
They do a really good job. It's actually got had factory involvement in terms that when they convert a car, when they traditionally convert a Ram to right-hand drive, they had to flip the steering box upside down and put it on the other side. The factory made them a run of mirrored steering boxes so they don't have to do that. And lots of little things like that they've done. Possibly the worst thing about the conversion is the foot-operated parking brake, which is in a very, very awkward place.
And it is.
It's not ideal.
Right.
But it doesn't really matter because you've got 1,084 newton meters of torque, so you really just can leave the handbrake on and it doesn't bother it.
No,
it
probably wouldn't. What a shockingly bizarre, probably impractical, but wonderful car.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everything about it should be just awful, but it's just so cool.
We had it parked next to a Fiat 500. And the bonnet...
I'll put a photo on the Facebook page.
Yeah. The bonnet of the Ram is the same height as the roof of the Fiat.
Wow.
That's how big it is.
Right.
It's just enormous.
And because it's so huge, you sort of think, oh, God, you know, it's going to be a bit awkward to get around. But people just about leap out of your way.
Yes. Yeah. There are, because there are a few of these already in New Zealand, left-hand drive versions, and they are notable by their presence, absolutely.
It certainly has presence.
So have they said how many are they hoping to sell? And
Some.
Yeah.
And
they will sell them.
It's a niche vehicle, but people will
buy them. I mean, they'll obviously have more luck in Australia than they would in New Zealand, because it's actually a vehicle that can make some degree of sense in Australia.
Yes.
Yeah.
If you want to move your house a little to the right...
Well, I mean, isn't it amazing that you've now got a vehicle on the market which makes the Ford Ranger look small?
It does.
Because the Ranger's just got ginormous, and so,
this is going to sound made up, but it is actually true. My driveway at home, which is quite narrow anyway, so it's quite hard to get the vehicle down there, and it's a little bit downhill. There's sort of a carport down the driveway, and there's a slight downhill to get into the carport. And I backed the Ram down, and I actually, because I was parked sort of on the crest of the slight downhill, but I actually fell out of it to the driveway because my foot slipped. And that was a long way down.
Yes. Oh, no. I bet all the neighbours were out mowing.
Well, I just quickly jumped up and looked around, and there's no one there, and I just pretended it didn't happen.
What you should do is actually pretend you're looking at something under the vehicle.
Yeah. Because it's got these big running boards on the side of it, which look ornamental, but you actually wouldn't be able to get into the vehicle without them.
No.
Has it got enormous mirrors as well? These trucks always got big mirrors, which extends the girth by another
two feet, three feet.
Everything about it is just comically oversized. I mean, you look at a photo of it, you think, oh, that's big.
Mm.
And you see it in real life at a distance, you think, oh, that's big. And then you get close to it, you realize, oh, that's even bigger than I thought it was.
The sun's behind it now.
Yes. Well, I'll tell you, I washed it in the weekend.
Ran out of water.
But you know the old joke about how you need a ladder to clean the roof of an SUV? Mm. Well, I literally could not reach the middle of the bonnet.
Right. Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's just huge.
But it's actually quite easy to clean because it's flat.
It is flat.
It's just like cleaning
a
house.
Just straight lines. Yeah.
Need a house washing company.
Washing company if you want to clean your room.
Yeah.
Anyway, utterly ridiculous but utterly brilliant.
Yeah. I'm going to bring things down to earth, actually, because I've been driving the Toyota Corolla Hybrid.
Oh, this is where you push the times two part of the podcast.
Yes,
talk about it.
Yeah.
Quick, at double speed.
All right. And over to Cameron.
No, off you go. Off you go. This Toyota Corolla Hybrid, oh, wow, it's setting the world on fire.
Well, the interesting thing about it...
I don't know how to finish that sentence.
is prepare for a shock. It is actually the best Corolla to drive.
It is.
So it's a Corolla. It's got a hybrid powertrain.
Double the handbrakes for your money.
You've got two handbrakes. Yeah. That was the bombshell I was going to leave to the end.
Sorry.
So it's essentially the Corolla that we all know and know. And it's got the powertrain from the previous generation Prius. So not the current Prius, which is a sort of, they've made a few improvements to that. Not many, actually, to be honest. But this is the last styling. This is the last generation Prius powertrain. So it's just marrying those two things. Mm. It's a model that's been around for a long time in Europe. They've always said they call the Corolla the Auris in Europe, and yes. they've had the hybrid version there. But the reason why it's significant, all joking aside, is that it is a hybrid version of one of the most popular cars in New Zealand. So it is truly mainstreaming hybrids. And Toyota's already done that with the Camry, obviously, and it's popular as a taxi and what have you. But they put this powertrain into the Prius. So it's about, it's 38,000 and something-ish dollars. I've forgotten the exact number. And it's $2,500 more expensive than a GLX, which is the model that it's based on. It's got a little bit of extra equipment. It's got keyless entry and it's got LED headlights and what have you. But sort of bang for your buck, it's very similar. Like the 0 to 100 times are quite similar. It's slightly heavier. It's 90 kilograms heavier, but that's the batteries which are in the middle of the car. And also, to fit the batteries in without sacrificing boot space, which they haven't, the boot is exactly the same, it's got a different rear suspension system. It's actually picked up a suspension system out of the European model. It's double wishbones, so it is actually a much better car to drive than any other Corolla.
Well, it would have a lower centre of gravity too. It does. With the battery, yeah. So it'd actually be...
So it is ever so slightly slower. I think it's about 0.8 to 0.9 seconds slower to 100Ks than a standard automatic Corolla. But it's much better to drive. And if you're going to buy a Corolla, it would be the one to buy. That's not laughing.
If you're going to rent a Corolla, do you think they'll put... this is an interesting question. You mentioned the Camry hybrid. Are there Camry hybrids on the rental fleet or is it just taxis?
That's an excellent question, and I do not know.
Because I wonder if they'd put Corolla hybrids on the rental fleets of New Zealand. I wonder if
it's probably not a powertrain that's at its best over long distances, I guess, so maybe not. I mean, I would imagine because they've sort of based it on the GLX, it's more of a fleet car, and it makes a lot of sense for, you know, people driving around the city. The fuel consumption figure is something like 33% better than a GLX. So, you know, it's like 4.1 litres per 100Ks or something. I just drove it normally for a week. I thought I'd do what you're supposed to do with one of these things, which is just commute back and forth to work and just drive it like a normal car. And I got 5.7 litres per 100Ks, and that was not trying.
That's right.
Good.
And so it works really well. I'm not going to say it's great to drive, but it's better to drive than any other Corolla. Bearing in mind, you know, the bad thing about Toyota hybrids is that they have continuously variable transmission, which, you know, goes but the thing is, your ordinary Corolla automatic has also got a continuously variable transmission and also goes so, you know, why not? And they're different transmissions. It's, you know, the hybrid ones are a fully electronic sort of setup. They are different gearboxes, but at the end of the day they're very similar in operation. Okay, I'm sensing a lull in the conversation.
I'm thinking about what I've got to buy at the supermarket. Hey, speaking of the previous generation Prius, we're going to see more of those soon too.
Yes.
Aren't we?
Because Toyota New Zealand. So, one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about this car was just to talk about whether Toyota, which was really a pioneer of sort of alternative powertrain technology with Prius, you know, 20 years ago. Is Toyota falling behind? Yeah. You know, where's all Toyota's plug-in models?
I know. What's happening? Well, they've put all their eggs in the hydrogen basket, haven't
they? They have. And they've
on a global scale.
Yeah, and, you know, they've launched a hydrogen car called the Mirai in, where can you buy it? Europe, United States, and Japan, I think.
Japan. It's basically like a sedan version of a Prius, doesn't it?
It is, yeah. And my understanding is they've been developing that car for about 10 years.
Yeah.
So that's, you're absolutely right, that's where all of their eggs have gone into that basket. And they've basically just let the conventional hybrid technology stagnate.
Yeah.
And they just keep recycling the same old thing over and over again.
Does that mean they're going to leap? Maybe they're going to leapfrog and they'll become the leading edge of hydrogen car development in 15 years.
I think that's the idea because, you know, if we can rewind back to when Prius was launched, people said something, you know, that was their argument then. You know, this is a landmark moment. You know, I've been working on this for 10 years.
Yeah.
And everyone just scoffed and said, oh, you know, that's, you know, what is this all about? Yeah. This weird sort of powertrain, you know, this, and look at where they are now, you know. Mm. So I think that's their theory. Yeah.
Interesting that Toyota and Honda with the Insight did that then.
Yeah.
And now Honda and Toyota are doing that with hydrogen.
They are. So, there's got to be something in it.
Yeah.
But anyway, a plug-in Prius does exist. We've never been able... We had some for evaluation actually here in New Zealand. I think Toyota New Zealand had three, was it?
Yeah, had a bunch of them floating
around. They had one at head office. I think Massey University might have had one. You know, these cars were floating around. That was never actually sold here because it was going to be too expensive. But now Toyota New Zealand is actually going to import plug-in Prius models, previous generation.
As part of the signature class.
Part of the signature class, which is very, very interesting.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, they've made a big, big deal about, you don't need any messy cables with that. Kind of going back on that sort of...
It smacks of desperation, really. I mean, the reality is they'd love to have plug-in cars here if they could. And, this is one opportunity to do that, to bring these used Priuses in. And if it was any other company, you'd probably be scoffing, going, used imports. But, Toyota's been doing signature class for how long? 15 years?
They do a pretty good job.
Even longer than that. And because I've done it before too, with the IQ.
Yes.
Bought that in as a signature class.
How did that go for them?
Not terribly well, of course. But,
no.
And even there, as long as they don't try a little cute marketing campaign where they give every plug-in Prius a name and a personality like they did with the IQ, which...
Less said about that, the better.
Moving on. All right, we'll race through this last, because I've been driving...
I'm going to laugh at your car, whatever it is.
Yeah, fair enough. You think about something else while I do this. Subaru LeVorg. Yeah, exactly. That has been the reaction a bit to that name. Let's talk about the name, because it's obviously the elephant in the room.
Yes.
Sort of an amalgamation. Japanese companies love to do this sort of thing. Amalgamation of legacy, evolution, and touring. Touring, I know. And I think it should be called the LeVorg with an H at the end, because you go legacy, evolution, touring. And it's funny because there's a couple of press vehicles on the fleet, and the one I had has got the LeVorg personalised plate.
Yes.
I had three people during my 5 days with that car say, "What's LeVorg?" Never ever clicking that it was the name of the vehicle. I think it sounds like such an unlikely name for a Subaru. But anyway, that's what they've decided to go with. Subaru New Zealand cited the Liberty situation in Australia, where they renamed the Legacy a Liberty because of some other reason.
Return services, it was. And it kind of became, I guess, on
a global scale, it's become a bit of a rod for their own. They've made a rod for their own back. So they're going to go with that international name. You kind of got the feeling from various sort of shrugged shoulders and screwed up faces that that's just the name. They've stuck with it. They just have to go with it.
Yeah.
What is it? It's essentially a WRX from the B pillar Ford, but it's a chief point of difference being that it's got a big station wagon boot, 522-litre boot at the back.
It's the same wheelbase as a WRX too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's slightly longer in the body, but same wheelbase. Because, of course, this car's here because the Legacy wagon, which has been deleted from the lineup, is such a much-missed vehicle for Subaru New Zealand. I mean, it's basically the car that Subaru staked their claim on the New Zealand market with. And there are real diehards that love the Subaru Legacy
wagon.
Now,
can I just burst your balloon here?
Yep.
This is revenge for laughing at it.
Yes, that's it is. Right,
yes.
I was going to save this, but I'll say it now. I've heard so much about what a much loved car the Legacy GT wagon was, and how we desperately needed this replacement, which is why they've created this LeVorg. Why didn't they just make a Legacy GT wagon? Because they have one.
Yeah.
They've got an Outback. It's exactly the same. It's just a bit taller.
Yeah.
If it was that important to have one, why didn't they make a Legacy GT wagon?
Just for the New Zealand market?
Just for whoever wanted it. Well, they made this LeVorg.
Made a whole new car, rather.
They've
made a WRX station.
They've made half a new car to satisfy that market. All I wanted to say.
Well, they seem to feel that their customers, it's a real psychological leap from a Legacy-sized wagon to an Outback SUV, remember? It's not a wagon, it's an SUV.
Not an SUV. But it
is quite a large vehicle. And they seem to claim that a lot of their customers have just sort of fled rather than buy into the Outback.
Yeah.
And the Outback's been the car that's basically, they've ridden on that car for...
Well, they're selling tons of Outbacks now.
They are selling huge amounts of Outbacks.
Like, they're selling... I think the Outback outsells, like, the XV, something like 3-1.
So this has been a bit of a bugbear for Subaru New Zealand. So they're very excited to have this vehicle here. It still fits. So it's still got the 197 kilowatt, 350 newton meter, 2 liter boxer turbo. It's good for 6.6 seconds to 100, and it's $56,990. But Subaru's never been particularly cheap. When you get up to those three magical letters, WRX.
Well, how much is a WRX?
It's about the same, isn't it?
Yeah.
54, something like that?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
You asked me to do extra work.
Sorry.
this car's basically, this does what the Golf R wagon or the Octavia RS is supposed to do for those ranges. I mean, it doesn't have, being a WRX, you think it would have a bit more sort of aggression on its sleeve. It doesn't seem to. It's quite a subtle car in a way.
Even the WRX is not as they even market it as what, refined performance or something.
Yeah, they changed tech with the latest one, didn't they? They wanted to leave that sort of boy racer thing behind.
Yeah, they do, which is, I think, a mistake.
Then they produced the STI, which was meant to have a big wing on it. So
right. Note to Subaru, don't put a huge scoop in the bonnet.
So it'll remain to be seen how much of these Levorgs they sell. It's still, 522 litre boot. I think it's the same size as a fourth generation Legacy.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem very big, when you're in it. It doesn't feel like a big wagon.
Because it's still riding on a relatively short wheelbase.
It's quite a lot of rear overhang
In that car. That's
I do actually, I have driven the car and I do really like it.
I like it.
Yeah. I like Subarus generally and I do like this car, but it does look a bit funny. It does look like a WRX with a backpack.
Yes. And I still think they would have got more mileage out of just calling it a WRX Touring.
Shooting brake.
Shooting brake.
I mean, all of a sudden now you've got a name in the Subaru lineup that makes Vortex sound normal.
Well, the other thing is we hear so much from car companies about how hard it is to launch a new brand, and you've got all this collateral and existing brands and things, and it just must be a real headache for them to have to just establish this new name now, and there must be a really good reason why they've stuck with it. Yeah. I remember back when the car was launched a couple of years ago, the local people were sort of saying, it looked really promising, but they'd probably change the name.
Is it available in the US as a Levorg?
Good question. Don't know.
That kind of drives a lot of their market decisions. Correct, whatever's happening in the US is what goes.
Yeah.
Long gone are the days where Fuji Heavy Industries paid close attention to Australia and New Zealand.
Yeah, that's true. It's gone down, I don't know how it does sales-wise, but it's gone down well in the UK.
Right.
It's had really good reception. But they're very keen on Subarus.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, that's an exotic car.
And they like their wagons.
Yeah.
They do, so it's perfect.
That's where the Golf Type R.
Yeah, as you say, it's in the UK, Subaru is a premium brand.
Well, over here it's a premium, I guess they like to... Subaru themselves like to market it. They always like to say, we're just a little boutique brand. We can't cope with the big... We're not going to compete with the big boys. We're going to do our own thing. But as you say, launching...
Look how many Outbacks we're selling! Yeah.
but then you say, launching an entirely new nameplate is a big ask.
Particularly when it's an awful name.
Anyway.
I do like the car.
Yeah.
I like the car it's based on. I like Subarus in general.
Yeah. It does a lot of things right. It does most things right. It does nothing particularly wrong except for its silly name.
Yeah, that's right. Anyway, that's what we've been driving.
All right. Well, I'm going to take the helm of the podcast just for a moment because our feature for this episode...
Would you like to sit in this chair?
Damien's sitting in the big chair at the big desk with the big microphone and three screens in front of him. And we're just like sitting on beer crates.
I was going to throw in a WizKids reference there, but I think people won't remember what WizKids was.
So my idea for a feature was really to issue a challenge to my fellow podcast presenters. It is said that you cannot truly call yourself a motoring journalist unless you've owned some iconic/oddball/interesting cars. And I thought it might be a nice idea for us each to talk about the three most interesting or iconic even cars that we'd owned. And so that was my challenge to Damien and Cameron. We haven't really discussed this prior to this. It's a bit of a surprise, or it's going to be a bit of a surprise.
I've never called myself a motoring journalist, so
you can leave. So I'm actually going to kick off with a bit of a bombshell. because my number one car, and I don't want to hear any sniggering.
Now, is this the car you're about to say, the one, and we're going to choose which of these cars we would actually buy again, or which we haven't sold?
Well, part of the idea, yes. Okay, my apologies. I've forgotten one of the key things was to choose what we think are the three most interesting cars we've owned. And then when we've all done our bit, at the end, we'll say which of our cars we would like to have back.
Okay.
Right. So, yeah, not just an example, like that very car.
No.
If you saw it on the street with a for sale sign on it, you know, which one would you buy back?
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm going to start off actually with the Daihatsu Sirion. Just to be controversial. These are in no particular order, by the way.
Was it one of those weird turbo ones? Was it?
No. I had a 2001 Sirion GTVI. Wow. In 2001. I bought it brand new, actually.
Oh, wow. Look at you.
And so this is the original Sirion, the weird-looking one that had the big goggle eyes.
Lots of chrome
on it. And it was sort of a retro sort of car.
Yeah.
Based on the Toyota Yaris as we know it now, but it was called the Echo back then.
Yeah.
So the reason why I bought it, and I was very excited about it was a bit of a sleeper. The GTVI had a 1.3 litre engine, so it's the same engine as you'd get in a Toyota Echo, but it had a Daihatsu variable valve timing system. It was called, I've written it down so I didn't get it wrong, dynamic variable valve timing. So it was a Daihatsu produced system unique to that car, and it had an extra 10 kilowatts over an Echo.
Whoa.
And okay, 10 kilowatts is 10 kilowatts, but two things.
Bit as light.
The red line was 7,500 RPM, Jeepers, and it would go more.
Yeah.
Oh, and right. It weighed 810 kilograms.
Yeah.
So
that would have been back in the day when variable valve timing was...
It was a big mental deal.
It was like turbos kicking
in. It was. You would hit 5,000 RPM and the car would just burst into life. And being a Japanese engine, it was absolutely indestructible. Yes. So you could actually drive it like that. Now, this is a car that would do 150 k's an hour in third gear.
Really?
Yeah, just because of the revs.
Fantastic.
So it was a fun car. It wasn't super fast to 100. It did 0 to 100 in under 10 seconds, I think. It wasn't, you know, it was like, wasn't even warm hatch territory, really.
Yeah.
It was just a quirky small car with just this mad, mad engine. So 91 kilowatts per tonne was the power to weight ratio, and that's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Not many cars that are 91 kilowatts per tonne. So I really loved the car. I absolutely ruined it by
doing that 5,000 all the time.
Back when I bought it, Daihatsu New Zealand was a thing that existed. It was a company. Yes. And the managing director was a man called Murray Hart, who was a great guy. He used to race a Sirion, actually. Mm. And he pandered to my idiosyncrasies and got me like racing suspension from Japan for it, and I put big wheels on it and everything and completely ruined it. It was just undrivable. And I had it that way for about a year, and then I failed a warrant because the guy said that didn't have enough clearance. And
so it was really low.
I was and so I was pretty cool looking. It was silver and it had these big silver wheels, and it was all covered in chrome. I was sort of secretly relieved that it failed the warrant, because it meant I could then proudly just put it back the way it was and say, oh well, I couldn't have it like that because, you know. So anyway, that was a car I really loved. Manual transmission.
Yeah.
You know, Japanese small cars with manual transmissions are always great fun to drive. Had a really good gearbox. So what happened to that model? When Toyota New Zealand took over Daihatsu in 2002, because Daihatsu was a separate company in New Zealand, when they took it over, they renamed it the GS, which was the first step backwards. And a spokesman at the time, I went back and actually reread the story I wrote about this back then. The spokesman from Toyota said that they weren't comfortable with it having a sporty badge, because they had a sporty Toyota Echo in the lineup. That was the Echo 1.5, which was substantially slower than the Sirion. And
did anyone at the time actually pull him up on the phrase sporty Echo? <'Cause I don't laughs>
So that was the first step backwards. Then the second step backwards was that they just dropped the brand completely in 2013, I think it was. So thank you, Toyota New Zealand.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
I think.
They went on with the Terios was their only vehicle, wasn't it?
Towards the end, there was a Sirion after this one, which was sold here, but it wasn't anything like as quirky. It was a very mainstream. Yeah. It was basically Echo Lite.
Yeah.
What was that big square Daihatsu? Was that the Sirion?
It was a Materia.
I quite
liked them, actually.
Yeah, so did I. Yeah. Really interesting. Yeah. Like a cube, like in the same cube.
So anyway, that's my number one sort of most interesting car that I've owned. Number two was the Fiat Multipla. Or, as us Multipla enthusiasts
don't do it. Pull back.
It's the Multipla Fiat.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Is it really?
Multipla. Originally, Multipla was the brand. So it was multiplied by Fiat. And the correct way to say it was multiplied Fiat.
Is that right?
Which I made a habit of doing and was...
But the multiplier is a historic name, isn't it?
It is, yeah. There's a Fiat multiplier in the 50s. Yeah. 600 multiplier.
Yeah.
So Fiat did what Citroën are trying to do with ES now. Right.
And they had about as much success. Anyway, so my multiplier was produced as a model from 98 to 2010. Mine was a 2003. It was almost new when I bought it. It was the proper original one, which looked like a spaceship.
Mm.
So for those listeners who don't know what a multiplier is,
you surely know.
We'll have to put a picture up.
We'll put pictures.
But pictures of
all not safe for work.
The thing about it is it's 3x3 seats, so yes. 2 rows of 3 seats.
Yeah. So you had the one with the porthole lights in the centre strip. Yeah.
The most awesome thing about a multiplier was when you're travelling at night and you had all the lights on, it looked like a flying saucer because there were 6 lights spaced quite a long way out, and you'd see these 6 lights coming towards you and think, what the hell is that? And then if you see it in the daylight, you go, what the hell is that?
Well, it's an interesting car because it was kind of designed from the inside out, wasn't it?
It was, and it was designed around a space frame platform, loosely based on the Bravo, which was sort of Fiat's mid-size hatchback. It was actually shorter than a Bravo. It was basically, in terms of length, it was like the size of a Toyota Yaris, for example. Mm. Like, it was really short, but incredibly wide.
Just about as wide as it was long.
It was over 2 metres wide.
Mm. Yeah.
And if anybody in this room can say that they've owned a car that's been displayed at the New York Museum of Modern Art, then... Now's the time to speak up.
He gets so defensive without anybody saying anything. It's like this built-in reaction to the word multiplier.
That's right. It's very well rehearsed. So it was part of an Automobiles for the Next Century display in 1999, so they got that wrong. But great car, loved it. Mine was a diesel manual.
Nice.
So virtually unsaleable. That's actually not true, because when I came to sell it, a bloke just turned up and loved it and just bought it straight away.
You still see in a big urban area like Auckland, you do still see them. I'd see at least one every couple of weeks probably, you know.
Yeah, there's a few around. Yeah. They don't look as shocking now as they used to, actually. I guess it's just... And they did do it. Fiat did it.
Ask my wife.
Fiat did this huge restyle in 2004 in an attempt to make it a bit more popular and just ruined it. They made it look like basically a normal hatchback, but it still had those odd proportions. It was still incredibly wide.
Great for moving house, which is what I did with that. They are great. When it was that next generation one was on.
So, I mean, in some respects, an old school people mover, you could take all the seats out and everything and do whatever you wanted with it anyway. So, yeah, that's my number two. Now, my number three is a car that I wouldn't have put on this list until about 2 weeks ago, when I had a revelation about it.
I thought you were saying when I bought it.
Back when I was probably just out of university, actually, I owned a Nissan Pulsar, an N12 Pulsar. Yeah,
Pulsar.
And like, I've always been into cars, but I didn't know much about it other than that it was a Nissan Pulsar, really, and it was sort of pre-internet days, so I didn't really do a huge amount of research. I just bought it because it was a good price and it was the sort of car that I needed at the time. And I've subsequently realised, actually after a story that Damien wrote on the Stuff website, about the Arna, which was the joint venture between Alfa Romeo and Nissan in the 80s to build a car in Italy using shared technology.
Right.
And they built this thing based on the Pulsar, and it was called the Arna, and Arna stands for Alfa Romeo Nissan something in Italian, starting with A. And so Alfa Romeo was in a huge amount of trouble in the 80s, like going down the gurgler, basically. Yeah. Didn't have a decent sort of small car and badly needed to compete with the likes of the Golf, which was, you know, hugely successful in Europe. Heavily unionised, sort of, you know. So they decided the best route to actually get a foothold in the European market with something decent and reliable and mainstream was to get into this joint venture with Nissan. And the current Nissan of the time was the Pulsar. And so what they did was they built a model based on the Pulsar, completely built it in Italy. The only thing I think that was imported from Japan were the body panels, which were made by Nissan.
Right.
So what looked like a Pulsar. You've got a blank look on your face, Cameron. No, you're not familiar with this car.
No, I'm not familiar. I'm familiar with the Pulsar, but not the Arna. No,
okay, well.
I imagine it looks like a Pulsar.
It does look exactly like a Pulsar. So it was based on the Pulsar platform, but it had Alfa Romeo suspension, had Alfa Romeo engines.
So you must have lifted up the bonnet at some point and gone, is an Alfa Romeo engine? Or did it have a big cowl across
it? I did not.
Is that right?
I did not.
Because I'm picking.
Yes, you know where this is going.
I know where this is going.
Yeah, I've telegraphed it.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was a complete disaster, to be honest. Alfa Romeo sort of collapsed in 86, and that's when Fiat took over.
Ah, right.
And the joint venture was just cancelled. It was a whole separate company.
And I think it has to be pointed out that the Arna was a truly awful car.
Well, the problem with it was it took the worst of both manufacturers and put it into one package. So you had Alfa electrics and engine. And you had Japanese styling and dynamics, basically.
Right.
So if you could have identified the worst aspects of each of those brands, they put them into one car. And it's hard to imagine how it actually happened. But when you know the reasoning behind it, you know, they wanted a really mainstream car to save the brand.
Yeah.
And it didn't.
Yeah.
And they only made about 50,000 of them in total. Right. But anyway, one of the quirks of this thing was that it was exported to Japan and called the Nissan Pulsar Milano X1.
Oh,
and that's the car I owned. And I'd never realized it until I read Damien's story and I was doing a bit of research around it and I came across this factette that it was exported as the Pulsar Milano. And I suddenly realized why my car had chronic overheating issues. The electrics never worked. But some listeners might remember these cars. They were really distinctive. They were bright yellow and they had green seats.
Wow.
Yeah, and black stripes.
Mm. Wow. And so, and an Alfa Romeo engine and suspension.
Yes.
Wow.
And build quality.
Yeah. Mm. Fantastic.
So it was a total turkey and therefore a really interesting car.
Yeah. And so this came in as a grey import and that's when you picked it up? Or was it actually sold new? And
no, it was never sold new in New Zealand. No, they came in as used imports. There were a lot of them around actually at the time that I bought mine. It wasn't a particularly sort of brave purchasing decision. There were tons of them around.
Sure.
Yeah. You know, it is also said that a motoring journalist cannot call himself a motoring journalist unless he's owned an Alfa Romeo. And I have, sort of.
Well done, sort of.
So I was just actually blown away by that.
Yeah.
And, how funny that I owned it all those years and never knew. It was awful.
the finest tradition of both of us.
But very interesting. And that's my lot.
It's your lot.
That's good.
That's my lot.
So, which one would you have back?
We'll do that at the end.
Oh, we're going to do that at the end. Sorry. Yeah. All right. Well, my cars are nowhere near as interesting as yours.
Okay. Well, over to Damien then.
No, I mean, my
Corolla hybrid.
Yeah. Look, I've owned, well, three cars that I've picked out. I've owned very boring vehicles for somebody who loves cars. But I guess my incessant need to get everywhere on time has meant that I've always chosen sensible rather than mad. But my first vehicle that I ever bought with my own money was a 1978 Honda Civic EB2.
Oh, that's pretty interesting.
Great little car, kind of the first of the, well, no, it's not the first of the Honda city car, certainly the first impact that Honda had in New Zealand with a little city car. We're talking about the roundy rear sort of Honda, the very early ones, which now...
Is that the first Civic?
No, the EB1 was the first one, which is sort of mid-70s. This is about a 78, I think.
Okay, I'm just trying to picture it.
It's not the squarish one that came in about 82. And the Accord was the same sort of style. So this is the round one. I was living in South Auckland and going out with a girl in the North Shore at this time, and I had this car, and I used to drive up and down the motorway all the time.
Obviously, got ideas above your station.
I know. Had to park around the corner, and this car just went and went until it didn't, blew a head gasket. But what a great little car it was.
Sounds like you're trying to sell it.
Yeah, great little car.
Great little runner.
That's just a car that I
wish I could picture what it looked like.
It was orange with a vinyl roof.
Oh, fantastic.
And black alloy wheel. Black steel wheels.
Yeah.
Okay. There was a lot. I've seen several clones of this. So it was obviously a look. It's obviously a part of the package that you could buy at the time.
Yeah.
So I'd go on Trade Me occasionally and look for old Hondas, and there are still a few around.
Yeah.
Some of them are actually in good nick, and you know, you can buy one for about $3,000. It's quite
tempting.
It is tempting. I've owned the obligatory Ford Escort Mark II.
I had an Escort.
Yeah, I think everybody's had an Escort. I had the Gear.
I've never had an Escort.
Check me out. With the vinyl roof and the square headlights. Yeah. Wrote that off after 6 months. It was a cracking car. Cracked lots of cracks in it after a while. Weirdly enough, I don't think, I mean, well, not to reveal all my cards right now, but I don't think I'd, people really lust after Escorts. They're kind of, I don't know, they're kind of, unless it's one of those sort of shovel-nosed 2000s, doesn't really get me all excited anymore.
I love Escorts.
I'm more of a Cortina man.
More of a Cortina man.
Yeah, that'd be right.
Yeah. It's the rep in me. Now, this one I shouldn't really even broadcast this, but a couple of years ago, on a whim, I don't know, and I still don't quite know why I bought it. 1967 Wolseley, 1660. I bought it on a whim and sold it with determination. It's a long backstory. When I was a young boy living in the rural part of Christchurch, rural outskirts of Christchurch, was a family friend had an old car like this and the same colour, and talking about badge engineering with Nissan and Alfa Romeo, this could have been a Morris Oxford or something like that.
Yep.
or any number of British Motor Corporation vehicles, but I always remember that sort of time in my life fondly, and I saw this car and thought I must have it. It was that sort of weird 1970s era Air New Zealand aqua green sort of colour. And a beautiful, beautiful old car, and of course, as with all old cars, it's old British cars. As soon as it rains, things start going wrong. What's that puddle under the car in the concrete? You can't get that part because that's a Wolseley. Nobody's seen a Wolseley for about 30 years. So I really enjoyed my 15 months with it.
The 1660, that was an Italian designed vehicle, wasn't it?
It was Pininfarina. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yep, that was
the only British car fact I know.
I think Austin had a Farina. It was called the A60 Farina.
Yes.
Which is a little hatchback version. And actually looks quite, I've seen one on mini light wheels. It's quite an attractive little thing actually. Yep. Probably wouldn't go, but it looked very nice. I think that's probably the least interesting to our audience. But I mean, I'm still glad I've owned it and I've put it away. Oh, the best thing about that car was the smell. You get inside an old British car of 60s, 70s, and it's a kind of a mix of petrol and leather.
Yes.
petrol and vinyl probably, but God, it just takes you back to your childhood, feeling sick in the back of Hillman Hunters and Triumphs and things. It really, just it's that smell never goes away.
Yeah, I throw up many times in the back of my dad's Triumph, so that smell. Mm. Yeah.
So that's mine. Not very interesting, I'm sorry, guys.
I was sitting down thinking about what cars I've owned and thought, not very interesting, but I did manage to come up with three that are quite interesting. Interestingly enough, they're all very small front-wheel drive cars, which surprised me. The first of which, of course, was a Mini.
Oh, wow. A 1000?
It was a Mini 1000, but it had been bought out to 1100 cc's. Wow. I bought it off an old guy in Hamilton who seemed to specialise in buying crap cars and putting sticky tape on them and then painting over it and things like that. this one, he'd literally done that to it. We were fixing something up around the back and looked up under the bumper and the paint was all crinkly. Once I sort of flicked at it, and it was masking tape over a big rust hole that had newspaper stuffed in it.
Oh, what year was the newspaper?
Sometimes the newspaper's really interesting.
I would contend, I personal opinion, I don't think there's ever been an era where the old Mini wasn't cool.
No.
It's always been cool.
Yeah, that's true.
I love that thing. It was again, that sort of sickly British blue and when I got it, again, it was sitting on radial tyres on the front and cross pliers on the rear.
Oh, excellent.
So it would actually take corners in about three stages. The front would track around and the rear would just go and lurch. Skip about three, yeah. So we quickly got rid of that, got a set of little white mini lights on it. Looked nice. Awesome. Had a big exhaust put on it and extractors, and that was because the original one fell off one day when I was driving along. But it was a fantastic little car. It was so much fun. Typically British car, you know, mini with the alternator at the front, so if it rained it wouldn't work, it leaked oil everywhere. One day I was flying up on mum's driveway and the brakes stopped, so I had to use her cabbage tree to stop the car. It was a massively fun car. I absolutely loved it, and the only reason it got sold was my mum sold it while I was away on holiday.
Oh.
In fairness, it had been sitting on her back lawn for about 18 months, possibly, at that stage. It was because it always had fuel starvation problems, and we'd done all sorts of things to it, and finally worked up the courage to pull off the fuel pump. And I say worked up the courage because putting extractors on a mini means that the fuel pump is hidden up under them, and you can only access it from underneath the car. And I got it off fine, but getting it back on took me at least a year of it just sitting on the backyard looking at it.
One attempt, but it just took a year.
It never happened. Yeah. So my mum sold it, and I loved that car, but I wasn't entirely unhappy to see it gone.
He's crying.
I was going to say, let it go.
Yeah, it's gone. Anyway, I believe it's dead now. It expired about 15 years ago.
I forgot to do, I was going to do that look up the number plate thing. I forgot to do it.
I looked up the, sorry to sidetrack us, but I looked up my Daihatsu one day just out of a fit of nostalgia, and it that had been written off. It had been ruined by a succession of people who put obnoxious personalised number plates on it.
Oh yes, because you can see the
then it was written off one day.
Anyway, so it was obviously an enthusiast car till the end.
It was a secret enthusiast's car. It was a car that not many people appreciated, but those who knew about it,
probably bought bikes. Succession of teenage girls
probably
to drive and who ruined it.
Anyway,
my next car was, well, not my next car, I had this before the Mini, was a Honda CRX.
Oh,
a 1985 first generation CRX.
Wow.
It was two-tone, red on top, silver on the bottom.
My now wife, my mother-in-law, when I first met her, had a CRX with a big dustbin lid exhaust on it. It's hilarious.
Well, you hardly see any of the first generation.
No, they've disappeared.
They have absolutely disappeared. And I can understand why, because the front, well, I think most of the front of the car was, it wasn't fiberglass and it wasn't plastic. It was some sort of weird resiny, and it just cracked around the bolts all the time, and you know, you had to keep an eye on it, otherwise the guard would drop off one day. So they'd probably all fall into bits. But that was a brilliant little car, a little manual. And it was based on the Civic, wasn't it?
I don't know, it was
because it was an 85, so it was a Civic based one.
Civic front on it,
yeah,
like Civic
Civic type style,
and it was it must have weighed nothing. You know, because it was probably quicker than a young lad buying his second car should have had. It was quite quick.
Because there was a bubble top version of that as well. I think there was a car with like...
The one after it was called the Del Sol in some...
That was the third generation.
Was it?
There were two generations. One was the real little sort of quite squared off one. And then there was a slightly bigger one, was the second generation. Similar shape. Same shape, in fact, but it had the funny little window.
Yep.
Maybe that's like what I'm thinking of.
Yeah, and then they did the Del Sol that had the weird roof that went into the boot and all sorts of silly things. Yeah. But that was a great little car, but probably my favourite car of all time that I've ever owned was a Peugeot 205 GTI.
Wow, that's proper.
It was a cool car. It was absolute piece of crap, to be honest. I mean, it was
build it up and tear it down.
Yeah, absolutely. I was sitting at the traffic lights one day in Mount Maunganui in summer, hot weather, and all the smoke's billowing past my window. I thought, someone's got a crap car back there, and I looked in the mirror and it was your car. Yeah, it was the Peugeot. Turns out that you couldn't actually fill it up completely with oil. You had to leave it at about three quarters, otherwise it would start burning it off
when it got hot. Oh,
but that was fantastic. It was a Japanese import.
Oh.
And when I got it, it had literally no oil in it. So that probably should have set off a few warning signs. However, it wasn't the engine that gave me trouble in the end. It was everything else.
Well, it is French.
It is French. Yeah. The engine warning light would come on all the time, and we could never figure out why. Proper mechanics could never figure out why. Eventually, I was going driving along one day, went over a bump, and the engine warning light flickered on, and I figured out it was just a loose connection somewhere. So I pulled the bulb out of the engine warning light and threw it away, and that solved the problem.
We had a car like that, but we had another Honda Civic, but it was the engine warning light that had the issue. It was always on. Nothing wrong with the car.
That's just reminded me that I used to have a 2CV and I forgot. Maybe that should have been on my list.
Yeah.
That story just reminded me, because one day when I started up my 2CV, it was red. It was a red special. And I started it up and there was an enormous explosion and I was covered in red powder sitting in the driver's seat.
Yes.
Really? Anyway, I digress.
Just went boom.
It was like someone had sort of exploded a pillow full of, you know, comedy red powder. Like something you'd see on a sketch show. Oh, anyway.
French cars.
So, Damien, I'm picking that you would, in a heartbeat, buy another one of those.
GTI? Mm-hmm. Yes, but then looking at them now, they had one out at the launch of the 308 GTI.
Yeah.
And it is terrifyingly small.
Yes. Very thin.
Thin doors, tiny labels.
Yeah, but you're not going to. These are not cars to drive every day.
No, they're not.
Yeah. I mean, but I know how I drove mine back when I owned it, and I'm wondering how I survived.
Yeah.
To be honest, because that's just a death trap.
Yeah.
But yes, I'd have one, but in a second. Absolutely love it.
Well, if I was going to. I don't actually know. I didn't decide. I thought I'd wait until we'd had our discussion and I'd mull over it. And although I like the Multipla, it was the absolute best car I've ever owned. I just loved it so much and I always regretted selling it and still do today. I think for the purposes of this podcast, if I could have one of those cars back, it would be the Nissan, because it's just such an oddball car.
Yeah.
And a real sort of little piece of weird history.
Yeah.
And that would just be a cool thing to have again, and I'm really sorry that I didn't appreciate having it in the first place.
Lift up the bonnet.
That's because I was so angry with it all the time, because it wouldn't do any more than 100 k's an hour without overheating. So.
No, it was definitely an Alfa.
It was, yeah. And I spent hundreds of dollars getting the taking it to a place called Radiator Services, just trying to get to cure the overheating, and this couldn't. Mm. And now I know why.
Yeah, it had solvable case of Italianness.
It did. Yeah.
Well, I think mine would be the Honda Civic. I probably alluded to that by the fact that I routinely look at Trade Me and search. One of my searches that I often go for. I think it was a cool little car, quite similar in its crumple factor, probably, to the Peugeot. You wouldn't even want to go up against the aforementioned Ford Ranger in one of those. But it was
the Ram wouldn't even slow down.
Well, no, it wouldn't. It'd be like a speed bump, wouldn't it? But I really like the little Honda Civic. I think it's an interesting. I mean, it's funny, you know. I think we're all of an age where the Japanese cars that we sort of grew, you know, we saw around when we were in our teens and 20s have been starting to become appreciating classics.
Yes, they have.
Yeah. Turn your head when you see something old like that.
Well, lots of them are going back to Japan now, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So I think to have an early Japanese car like a Civic would be, really interesting. As you say, David, not the sort of car you drive every day, but maybe bay four of the four bay garage, you know.
Oh, no, that's another podcast.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, and speaking of another podcast, I think that's probably as good a place as any to stop.
So what we don't do it. We don't do
on for long enough.
We don't do quantity, but we do quality.
We do, yeah.
We've actually just revealed ourselves to all be incredibly old. And
we have actually just been
chased half the listeners away.
Yeah, old men reminiscing about cars they owned.
Yeah.
Isn't that how every podcast ends up?
I think so.
Oh, that's right.
Probably. That's pretty much standard.
Yes.
Anyway, thank you very much for putting up with that, listening to us. We promise we'll get another one out sooner the next time. But I think we
said that last time.
That's my sign off now. We promise we'll be more regular. Okay, well, thank you very much for listening. And don't forget to check out some of the other podcasts available at podcasts.nz, like the New Zealand Tech Podcast or the New Zealand Entertainment Podcast. Worth a listen. Probably more regular than this one. Goodbye.
The New Zealand Motoring Podcast. Brought to you by podcasts.co.nz.